morning to all. About to start in about 2 minutes, resuming Qoheleth. We did the story of Bilam last week in the donkey, and then we're going back to Qoheleth, chapter 3. And we'll start just in about a minute or two. Chapter 3, we're already up to about verse 9, 10, 11. We actually read through up to 17, as Ibn Ezra says, that the entire first 17 verses here are all connected. So we read through them and opened up the area a bit. And we'll start just in one moment. JHS. And like I was saying, that we'll continue now with verse, again, chapter 3. And we'll pick up from about verse 10. And again, there's a lot of ideas here, so we're showing the sequence, what the connection is. And we'll just wait for our friends to call in, and then we'll start. Okay, so just in about 20 seconds or so, 30 seconds, whenever they call. Or 10 seconds. There we go. Morning, Doug.
Good morning, Rabbi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing okay, fam. Jim, are you still there?
Yes, I am.
Good.
Who's that? Jeremy?
Jim.
Okay. Cal's with us? Cal's there too? Josh?
Yes, I am.
Okay.
Yeah, I haven't heard Josh.
And Rivka?
And I have not heard Rivka yet.
Okay, I guess I'll chime in shortly. Did you have my email, Cal?
Yes, I got it.
Okay. So you're coming in on when? Tuesday or Wednesday?
Coming in Wednesday.
Okay. What time?
Oh, let's see. I think we get into Newark at around 5 p.m., so we will probably get up into Far Rockaway around
7:30.
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm guessing 7:30 or 8.
So the timing may not work out then on Wednesday.
Okay. Let me just grab another piece of paper and I'll double check the flight time. I'm going off memory.
I know. It's true.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, thank you for the invitation.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah, so we'll see. We'll play it by ear, see if there's any other time slots that open up.
Okay.
And I realize also, you know, there's no problem in terms of, I think Josh wanted to record the classes. I think most of the classes, though, are going to be on Sunday, right? Maybe one by, I think, Matt Schneeweiss doesn't do one, I think, on Shabbos. But for the most part, the different presentations, am I understanding right? Because I didn't see any schedule yet. Did you see anything?
I haven't, and I asked Arena if she could send me that, and she said she'd get it to me very soon, because I told her we were leaving earlier before the conference, and that I wanted all that prep before we left. And,
okay.
I haven't seen anything either. But I suspect because Rabbi said he had plenty of speakers that there, you know, I think Jesse and maybe Doug and I will be speaking probably during the Shabbat.
Okay.
Time.
Very good.
Are you going to be going up to Plainville View and staying up there?
Yes, I'll be staying there for the Shabbos, so we'll have a nice time.
Good.
We'll have a nice time all together.
Time.
Yeah, I hear that they got the meals and everything. Who's that, Rivka? Somebody just joined on, Rivka?
Yeah, hi, good morning.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Okay, so, all right, so we'll wait until he has the final schedule, and we'll work it from there. And, all right, so we're going to wait just another moment for Josh to join on. I know he just had a baby.
He's usually right on time.
Okay, any questions? Maybe you want to, if there's any questions you have, we can take that before we start. So maybe in the meantime, he'll join while we're... Okay, and Laura just joined on from, I guess, Seattle, too. Hey, Laura, how are you today? And Yeshua. So everything was clear last week on Bilam. Very interesting how the whole story unfolded, huh?
That was wonderful.
I mean, just amazing how all the detail in there. Just, or something. There was another story we were discussing on Shabbos. The whole question came up regarding the Talmud and the rabbis. They talk about what a demon is. So, Maimonides clearly... Is that Josh? All right.
Hey, it's Naomi.
Hey, Naomi. Good morning. And so, Laura in Seattle, saying hello to everybody, by the way.
Greetings, Laura.
Okay. So we're talking a bit about, demons, what they are, and so we could discuss two things. That, and also there was one peripheral point that said that when all living things came to Noah when he built the ark, so all the animals came to him, he didn't have to go out and really do much in terms of God made a miracle, and it was very easy for the animals to come. So it says also in Rashi, a commentary, he says, everything that was living came to Noah, to the ark, even demons. So it's like, what does that mean? But if you look through the Talmud, it talks about what demons are. So the Talmud just says, don't give greetings to them. That's all it says regarding it. It just says, advice, don't talk to them. But it also tells you that demons are only found in four places. Either on the tops of mountains, in caves, at nighttime, or in the middle of the desert. So again, you have the rabbis are trying to point you to something. So we were discussing it, and we realized that what those four places had in common. I mean, what does it mean that they're only found in those four places? There's no, walls that they can't get around. Any place that we can go, any living being can go to, a terrestrial being, I guess, we'd be able to go to the desert, to the mountaintop. So why can't it go into a city? Why can't it go into somewhere else? Why is a demon limited just to being on a mountaintop, in a cave, at nighttime, or in the middle of the desert? Why can't it come out of the cave? Why can't it leave the desert? Why can't it leave the top of the mountain? Well, what happens when it's not at nighttime? It just evaporates? These are actually the words of the rabbis when they're discussing what a demon is. And again, it said that everything living came to Noah, even, and of course the words of the Torah don't say it, but the commentary, Rashi says, even demons, meaning included, when we say that everything living came to Noah on the ark, so that means even demons came. So what does that mean? And why only, what's specific about Noah and the ark? What about the times of Moses or King David? How come there's no demons then? So, what we said was that the rabbis are teaching a psychological principle, and that is all these four places have one thing in common. Mountaintops, caves, the middle of the desert, nighttime. These are all situations where a person is isolated. When a person is isolated, And you see that solitary confinement is the worst punishment in prison, worse than anything physical, because the greatest need in man is the social need. And if he's away from people for too long, he's lost in the middle of the ocean, it's a terrifying experience. It's the loneliness, can kill a person. So when a person had to travel, whatever the needs were, he found himself in these four situations where he's isolated, the natural response is that a person will imagine that there's somebody there with him, because the need is so strong. It's like a mirage, the same type of a principle. The mind will construct something, like a daydream. And what the rabbis say is, this is a truth, it will happen, this is the way we're wired as human beings, it's a psychological truth. We have this need, and the mind has the ability to create a phantasm, to create something which really isn't there, when the need is so great. But the rabbis say one thing, don't give it greetings. Meaning, don't raise something which is a fantasy to reality and start talking to it. Then you're crossing the line. Yes, you will experience this. And then there's nothing you can do about that. And there's no penalty for that, because that's not something which you're doing out of your own volition. It's something which is a natural thing. Just like you cut your artery, you will bleed. They just say, if you happen to be in a situation, don't start elevating it to a reality. You have to keep the lines clear between what's fantasy and what's reality. That's why they said, don't give greetings to it. That's it. And that's why it makes sense that it was also, the Rashi says, that the everything that was alive came to Noah on the ark, even demons. Why? We can answer it now. What do you want to say?
Because that tendency in man to do that came along with Noah and his sons and their wives in the ark, so it was carried through to mankind today.
Well, then that would be the same for any psychological principle. Why would they just focus on the psychological need for a company?
Well, unless he's referring to that they had those demons with them in the ark, the fact that they were alone that entire time.
Exactly, exactly. That answers the question, too, but why was only demons mentioned in connection with Noah? Because that was a time of isolation. The entire world was now destroyed. And all was left was eight people out of the whole world. This was a very traumatic experience for Noah and his son, his three sons, and his wife and his three daughter-in-laws. So that's what Rashi's pointing to. That the feeling, even though there was eight of them, you don't have to be completely alone to have this need. Even if there's a small group of people that are isolated from the rest of the world because the rest of the world is now annihilated, they can also experience together, they experience isolation. It's like people on a ship, and they get shipwrecked. You can have 200 people, but if they're all on this island shipwrecked when nobody even knows where they are, all those 200 people, even though there's a whole bunch of them, they can all feel the sense of isolation. So it doesn't necessarily mean that you're alone. It means that how you view you and the rest of the world. So if the rest of the world is out there and there's only 200 of us here, so then the same thing. But now we see why it's the ark, exactly like you said, Doug, because that was the situation. They were isolated. And I can give you a nice insight as to that would support this. And that is that when God told Noah to make the ark, he also told him to make this thing called the Tzohar, the Hebrew word Tzohar. And Rashi says, some say it's Tzohar means a bright stone, which personally I never heard of, any stone that glows. And the other opinion is that Tzohar means a window, that God told him to make a window. All right. But later on in the story, in Noah, after the rain had stopped, so it says that Noah opened up the window, not the Tzohar, but he opened up this thing called the Chalon. Chalon means a window. So why does the Torah change the word? If God told Noah to make a Tzohar, which is either a bright stone or a window, evidently both were for some illumination, so why does the Torah then say later on that Noah opened up the Chalon, which clearly is a window? That's the only interpretation. It's changing the word. And what does he do when he opens the window? It says he sends out the raven. Doesn't say why. And then I think like 7 days later, he now sends out the dove, And there, the Torah says, why? To see if the water's dried up. So, why is the Torah not disclosing why he sent out the raven? I understand you want to send out the dove, because your immediate vision only shows water. So maybe the thing, the dove can fly past the horizon and come back and give Noah some, peace of mind that the waters are drying up. If it brings back a leaf or something like that, that means that the earth is starting to reveal its surface again. But it only says that by the dove, and that was the second bird he sent. The first bird that he sent was a raven. Why a raven? And why doesn't the Torah tell us why he sent it? And again, why does Noah make this thing called a chalon, a window, when God told them to make a tzohar? Why does it, well, it seems like he made something else. You see the questions?
Yes, we do.
So what we were saying was that, because we came onto this because we were talking about the whole isolation issue and the demons, because God thought somebody had mentioned a question about demons, what does it mean? So we got onto that. And it just naturally flowed, no pun intended, into the story of Noah and the flood. And what happened was that we said like this. We said that Noah had a concern, and the concern was that isolation. So therefore, he makes a window. God says, "Make it tzohar." He makes a window, which is fine. There's no penalty. But it's trying to show you, and the verse also says that Noah opened up the window that he made, which would seem to imply that it was of his own decision, not God. That's why it says, and Noah opened up the window that he made. So, he sends out the raven. Torah doesn't tell you why. I believe the reason is that a raven is a flesh-eating bird. And Noah had a concern about what he was now going to be confronted with after this whole catastrophe was over. These people that he knew, the bodies that are around, is he going to be confronted with a mass grave or corpses? Is this something, because this was a concern, he was bothered. You see that he was bothered, that's why he made a window, and that's why the Torah does not disclose why. Something which is a little bit gory or something which is distasteful, the Torah will conceal, so it does not say why he sends out the raven. But you see, he sends that out first. That was even more of a concern than whether the land had dried up. So it does not say why he sends out the raven, but you know that a raven is a flesh-eating bird. And you see that he opens up the window that he made. So this was all on his mind. This was a bothersome thing. When it sends out the dove, so then the Torah tells you why, to see if it, you know, if the waters had dried up. So with the omission of why he sends the raven, it raises a question. But the type of bird that it is, and the fact that Torah omits it, is something which illustrates more about human psychology, and that's important for us to know. That's why it's in the Torah, to teach us what was Noah going through. So there was definitely, this supports the idea that Rashi says about how even the demons came on. There was isolation, a tremendous problem of isolation that they all experienced on that ark during that time, during that year's time. So it also says when he left the ark, the first thing that happened to Noah is that he drank, he got drunk. He was removing himself from reality, as Rabbi Chait explained. That's what drinking is. He planted a vineyard, and this was because it was a bothersome thing. It's like, imagine being marooned on the moon. You're in a spaceship, and you've got a couple of other friends with you that are your fellow astronauts, and now communications go, and something happens, and you land on the moon, you can't get off, and that's it, and there's no contact, and as far as you're concerned, you think that NASA thinks that you were just killed, so they're not going to send out any missions to find you, and barring the fact, you know, let's say you had enough air and food, whatever, but the fact that you're stuck there and you can't get off could be the most frightening thing. So this was also, I feel, was the same thing was going on with Noah.
Rabbi?
Yes.
So I'm a little confused about the raven part because, I understand the concern about you having to find bodies all over the place, but what does sending out a raven do to help that?
Okay, good. Yeah, I'm glad you asked. Right. I missed that point. If the raven comes back and he sees there's some remains on the beak of the raven or flesh. So, or if he's got something in his mouth and he can see it's human remains, that's going to be something which would be bothersome. You hear me? I'm getting some feedback.
Yeah, no, I hear you.
Okay. Maybe if it was delayed and it didn't come back right away. He was looking for some signs of whether or not there were human remains out there, that he would have to confront this. It was bothersome.
Okay, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. Okay, but we're really doing Koheles today, so...
Right.
So let me not change the subject any further, unless there's any questions. But I thought you'd appreciate, again, like Rebbe Chait, that it was like always, you know, the main point, let the words talk to you, he would say. And you just look at the words in the Torah and they will deliver the ideas. So you see right from the fact that it says he sent out a raven, that he opened the window that he made, and it was a window, it wasn't a tzohar, it changed a word. And it doesn't tell you why he's sending out the raven. All these things are generous clues in order to point us towards unraveling the whole story. So if we're just sensitive enough to those words, we'll start seeing more and more. It'll just open up. And today in Koheles is going to be no exception.
So I have one follow-up question. If I recall, the raven did not return.
No, I think it did. It went back, okay. It went back and forth. There's actually a Talmudical... address to this whole thing, which is a completely different angle.
Yeah.
Which I still don't understand. So, if you look at it, you have some ideas, you know, let me know.
Okay.
By Wednesday.
Rabbi, I was also thinking, I don't know how many people have seen that movie Castaway a long time ago, but that movie really depicted what goes on to the, you know, the mind and how he recognized how easy it was for his mind to play tricks on him.
Right.
And he had that, I think it was a soccer ball or something that he sort of attached himself to so that he would have something else that represented another human being to bounce his thoughts off of.
Right, exactly. Exactly, that's right. That proves the point. Well, it's a movie, but, I mean, it's based on the truth, so...
And if I'm understanding what the rabbis are saying right, they would say, don't talk to that soccer ball.
Correct.
So what would a person do, like, you know, in that situation if they need, you know, they need a demon?
What would they do? I mean, it would be uncontrollable if the mind is creating it, but they should just recognize this is a function of the mind, and it's really not there, and there's a strong need to understand that. The person should definitely have the conviction that, you know, God is aware of his needs, and he can, you know, that should satisfy some level of communication. So, you know, praying to God in that situation is what the Torah's prescription would be. But you can't blame the person if certain people have different level of emotions. Everybody does. Certain people will handle themselves better in isolation than others. But all people are susceptible to this.
Rabbi, that kind of ties into, isn't it a strong indication in the Torah that man is not meant to live in isolation?
Yeah, of course. There's even, I think it's Psalm 107, if you take a look. King David talks about the four different cases of a person that either he got lost in the desert, lost at sea, he was in prison, or he was severely sick, where he has to now give thanks to God in front of 10 people that he was saved. But you see, the two of them, lost in the sea or lost in the desert, is what we're talking about here. If you take a look at it, I think it's Psalm 107. It talks about four different cases. And why does he single those out? That's an interesting thing. And by the way, if there's anything that, you know, in the next couple of days while we're, you know, leading up to the Noahide conference, so if you have any topics or questions you want me to address there, because, you know, since I'll be there for the weekend and then we'll have the classes throughout, so I'd be more than happy to look up that as well. I'm going to be taking up the Torah's view of the religious equality in terms of, you know, Jew or Noahide. And I've been basing it on a Talmudic area in Sanhedrin, which we may have touched on in terms of what was initially commanded and different views in the Talmud. I mean, what was initially commanded to Adam? Was it one command? Was it two commands? Was it three commands? And what did Noah have? And what were maybe the themes? But the, you know, just in terms of having an opportunity for more of a loose discussion. So if you have any other questions, just, you know, let me know. I'm more than happy to spend some time on that. Okay. So now, unless there's any other questions in Noah, we'll now go back to Kellis. All right. So we're in Kohelis. We're in chapter 3. We were about... we went through up to verse 16. And as we're going through it, we're seeing more and more layers unfolding in terms of the ideas. And we basically gave a theme that is talking about how a person is looking for something which is going to give him security and happiness. Because that's where he has some stability, and he can look at something and say, this is good always. Then the person gains security because he knows he's got a security blanket. This thing is always a good. Whereas King Solomon is telling you in the first 8 verses that there's a time for this, there's a time for that. Something is not always a good. Peace is not always the right thing to endorse. Or dancing is not always the right thing. Or laughter, or crying. Any one of these attitudes. So, but he says that, as we said, because a person is looking to have something that he can point to and say, yes, this is always a good. Because that will give a person security in life. So King Solomon is telling you that is not where you get security. Security has to come from wisdom. You meaning you always assess your situation. You always assess your situation on a daily basis, and you see what is necessary today. What was, and you can even plan something for tomorrow. But when tomorrow comes, a new consideration entered the picture. Now you have to change your plans. So a wise person is not going to be stuck. A friend of mine, I think Jeremy Campbell is the name, told me once. He said that he was quoting the rabbis or Rabbi Chait, I forget who. He says that a wise man is one that can change. So you don't have an absolute view of something, and that's exactly what King Solomon is saying. Nothing is absolute. Assess your situation and make the change. And that's what King Solomon says. Let's see. Where's the verse? Right, so in verse 10, he says, and I've seen the matter that God has given to the sons of Adam, the sons of man, to afflict him. So it doesn't mean that God wants to afflict man. It's like we quoted Micha, I think that's where it is, Lamentations, where he said, God does not afflict from his heart. Anything God does. Koma da'asa Hashem l'tovasa. My friend Joel told me this week. We were talking on the phone, and he says, the rabbis have another saying, that anything which God has done, he has done for good. That's apparent. I mean, that shouldn't be like a new point. Like we say in Hebrew, a chiddush means like something new. This is something which is obvious. Of course, you look at the world and how everything is beautiful looking, and how things just taste fantastic, and there's so many varieties of fruits and varieties of beautiful birds, and everything you see is for the good. Everything in the body works and functions in order to give the person to live. Nothing is malfunctioning. 99.99% of the time, a person is in good health. So you see that's a fact. But when it says here that God has done this in order to la'anos, to afflict man, it means that to train man against his predisposed emotional leanings. Because we just follow the emotions, and then we'll be like Adam. You see, the verse does say, the sons of man. We did not mention this last week or 2 weeks ago. In the verse 3:10, it says, I've seen the matter which God has given to the sons of Adam to afflict him. So we, the Sforno we read, but I don't think we picked up on this nuance. Sforno says, in order that man should be humbled, and he should not rebel like Adam the first did. So Adam the first was in a situation where he didn't have to work, where he had everything in front of him. And now his energies went into rebelliousness. He wasn't preoccupied with having to search after his needs. He had everything. So God now reversed that plan and now forced him to work and to labor for his bread and to be involved in morality and to have to think into areas and be humbled before God. And this pursuit now would have him to assess what has to be done on a daily basis. As opposed to before, where he was spoon-fed. Now he has to assess on a daily basis. So maybe that's why he brings in over here that this whole idea, that there's a time for this and a time for that, means that God is trying to force the person away from attaching himself to an absolute view of things. This is always good or this is always bad. That's a very easy type of life. You don't have to use your mind to decide. But God wants the mind to rule. So therefore, he causes man to engage in a constant assessment of what he needs on a regular basis. Sometimes a person gets very complacent and is living a very repeated type of a lifestyle, and he gets into this rut where he's not progressing. He's not addressing areas of his life because he's just repeating his behavior. So now, you know, a monkey wrench can be thrown in for his good. It wakes him up, makes him start thinking about how there's other things that you have to now address in order to propel yourself and to further human perfection. So that was what God did with Adam. He had all the foods. He was naked. There was no sense of morality. There was no need to be involved in an area. He was involved in thought. But due to this, the situation where he had all the good and there was nothing to really assess, so the emotions kicked in. And they were not, because the mind was not being followed through in terms, it wasn't addressing so many areas of the day. When he was involved in thought and naming the animals, that was a good. But once he was out of that area, so what was now going to cause his mind to engage itself the rest of the day? Nothing. There was nothing he had to do. He didn't have to work. He didn't have to get clothing. He didn't have to get food. It was all there. So where would the energies go? They naturally went to the emotions. And since he used the emotions and he disregarded the command not to eat the foods, that showed, that illustration, right, in the beginning of Genesis, showed us how if man would have used it properly, that would have been the best state. And eventually, in the future, making a living and so on is going to be much easier. And Judaism will be recognized by the whole world as being absolute true. And all the other nations, like the prophet says, they will say, our forefathers inherited to us, they bequeath us lies. We have inherited falsehoods. All these religions that we have are completely nonsense and foolish. That will happen in the future. So it'll come back to that type of state. Because that is the best state where the learning could be the focus. And going after the livelihood, if we could minimize that and spend more time in learning, that would be, of course, a benefit. But for the meantime, this is what we have to be engaged in. But you see why? Because the complacency will now just allow the emotions to emerge and rule and rebel against even what God says, even one command he couldn't keep. So that's why the verse says over here that this is all part of the plan. I've seen the matter, 3:10 in Kohelis, I've seen the matter which God has given to the sons of man. Why the sons of Adam? Because we are duplicates of him. We have the same psychological makeup, and we need to have the same corrective measure applied. So therefore, God has now made the world in a way where things are not absolutes. There's a time for this, there's a time for that. Now you have to assess things on a daily basis. Now this will cause your mind to be engaged and to be thinking into matters. And the duties of the heart says the same thing. Why work is a benefit? Because if man didn't have to work, he would involve himself in sin. And another reason he gives is because by being involved in work and dealing with other people will allow us to express our values. Are we dealing justly with other people? It will allow us to express in more ways our conviction in what is true and what is false. So by having to have different ways of harvesting and food and how we treat our family and how we deal with business. So this whole pursuit, which Adam didn't have, but we now have, allows us to express our merits and to earn the righteousness before God.
Rabbi?
Yes.
Does this imply then that in Gan Eden, I would assume that there were no seasons, and was there a difference between night and day? Because that forces change on us.
Yeah, there was night and day, for sure. But there were no, you should know that the Ran, Rabbeinu Nissim, he explains that the same day that Adam was created, he sinned, and God rebuked him and drove him out of Eden. It all happened in the same day. Meaning it was a very quick type of a... It just showed you how essential it was that we do have morality. Because we were created without the sense of morality. We were just created with the sense of what's true and what's false. That's scientific truths. But morality did not exist. That's why there was no embarrassment. But the fact that he sinned the same day he was created, God shows you that it was impossible to exist that way. Even though it would have been preferred, but the way the human being was, God always allows man to make his choices and in response to man's choice. So in terms of the seasons and all, it would seem to be they were always from the beginning. There was only a very, very brief few hours, whatever it was, between his creation and his sin. And the only time you see that the seasons were talked about as being changed is during the flood, when God says afterwards he will no longer, you know, suspend, you know, winter and summer and so on, and heat and cold. Evidently, during this time of the flood, the entire natural world was in chaos. They weren't following the set laws. Prior, they were, and subsequent, they were. But during the flood, that year, they weren't. Okay. So you see how the verses here are continuing on this theme of that man should not attach to the and say that anything is absolutely good or bad, meaning he has to use his mind and not just look for emotional security blankets, that this is always a good. No, you have to use your mind. And that's what it's called over here, we're the sons of Adam, because it really came from that point forward. Is that point clear?
Yes.
Okay. Now we said in verse 11, we said a very important verse here. It says, everything which God has done, he has made perfect or good in its time. Even the world he has placed in their hearts that they should not know the matter from beginning to end. Meaning God planted in man the sense of immortality. That's what this verse is telling you. Right, Cornyn? That's clear in the rabbis say. Right, I think it's Ibn Ezra. Right. Where he says that the world has been planted in the heart, that the children of man should be involved, and they should live as if they will live forever. He says. And then, and because they're involved in this type of a mindset, they will not understand the matter from beginning to end. Okay, so therefore, you see that when he says that, he says the word time again in the beginning of this verse. He says in 11, all has been done in this right time. Again, he's going on with the theme that there's a time for this, there's a time for that. But sometimes the duration of a certain thing is a very long period. Like, for example, sometimes it's good to have war, maybe for, you know, a month or two. All right, then you squelch the enemy and so on. Then it's good to have peace. But then you have this concept of the immortality fantasy that God has created in a man's mind. There you see that that's a good thing for the life of a person. The duration is for many decades. Still, it has a term. So that's why it says even that is also good in its time. But a period of time of how long something should be appropriate can be for many decades too. But you see, the King's Commentary says that God did this in order that man should not see the matter from beginning to end. So man should be involved here as if he's going to be here forever. Now, we have to understand why that's important. And he says in the next verse, and you keep in mind that, as Ibn Ezra said, all these verses are connected. Verse 12, he says, King Solomon says, I know there is nothing that is better for man other than he should be happy and to do the good in his life. Okay. So what does it mean, of course, in his life? What is that last word in 12 doing there? When else is he going to do the good? We know that there's no more chance to do the good after we die. That's what the rabbis say. Whoever prepared for the Sabbath will eat on the Sabbath. That's a metaphor that anybody who prepared here will enjoy the next world, which is called the Sabbath. But if you didn't prepare here, if you didn't live the right life, so you won't have the next world. So, of course, the only time we can do good is here. So what is he saying that in the end of 12? That I know that is the only thing that's good for man is that he should be glad and to do the good in his life? Of course in his life. And also, what's that verse doing following the previous verse about the fact that God planted the immortality fantasy in us? So we basically deny death our whole lives. That's what we're going to take up now. Yes.
Well, it seems like verse 11 would go against the way that I would think of it, because if man is given a fantasy of immortality, then he would live like there's no end. Whereas if a man isn't given that sense, then it would seem like he would recognize very clearly all the time I have an end, and would constantly be adjusting his activities to take that into account. So it would seem like, in terms of, you know, the world to come and, you know, preparing for the Sabbath, so to speak, as the rabbis refer to it, that a person who didn't have that sense of immortality would be in a better position than a person who did.
Well, right. I mean, the wise man and the rabbis do make that statement. You can't deny death. But it seems to be that both are true. On a regular basis, day to day, a person has to feel, he can't feel like he's dying today. A person just won't be able to function. He has to have that honesty, you know, in the back of his mind. But the what's planted in man's heart, the most predominant feeling is I'm going to be here for a long time. The question is, what is the need for that? Why is that a good? Because according to what you're saying, it's better off that he shouldn't deny. He'll be preparing for the next world. But evidently, that's not a good. The question is, why? Why is it not a good to be always preparing for the next world?
Well, it would keep you out of being in the present moment. I mean, you'd always have your eye probably on the future instead of in the now.
Right. And now, why do we have to be in the now? And this is really getting on to that last word in 12, that what the good is that man should do the good in his life. I mean, you'll see how it fits in, but go ahead. Why is it now? Let's go to the next step. Let's follow through. So you're saying that evidently some man has to be involved in the here and now. That's a good. Okay, why? How is that a benefit? To have the ability to deny the next world.
Is it because the future and in the past is more fantasy?
No, the future will happen. The past is nothing we can do about it.
Right, but you still, like, even when you look in the past, sometimes they talk about the good old days, and then in reality, was it the good old days? Or are you just remembering the good things?
Right, people have selected...
It keeps you in a fantasy state rather than a reality state.
But people do that. They do think about the past. The question is not.
Rabbi?
The question is not regarding. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking that perhaps two things. The if you live in the now, number one, because eventually, everything is the now. The past was once the now, the present is the now, and the future will be the now. And secondly, the life, the last word, God has given this to us. And if we don't live in the now and in
and accentuate living in this life, then we're throwing away what God gave to us.
Good. Okay, good. Good step. Meaning it's essential that if God is saying that you have to live in the here and now, so now that's really what is the best. Now the question is, why is that the best? In terms of what? What now we have to do is step back and look at what is really the whole good for man. How would you define the whole good for man? What is the optimal good for man?
Haven't we defined that as being involved in the world of learning and growth?
Right. Being attached to truths and valuing what is real. Okay. Now, what would happen if over my shoulder I'm always looking at the reward I'm going to get at the next world? How will that impact the optimal good for man? I mean, if I don't have the immortality fantasy, and death is a reality to me as much as my left hand, so that means I'm always going to be faced with, okay, what's my reward in the next world? See, that's why the Torah has hidden it and doesn't really talk about the next world so openly. There are references, because it's the truth. But the Torah doesn't want that. What does the Torah want? That in order that we are involved in truth, is that when we sit down and we learn, or when we engage with other people, what we do is for the thing itself and no ulterior motive. I can only do that if I feel I'm here forever. You see, if I'm really going to value learning a piece of Koheles or learning a piece of Torah, it could be only that I have nothing else in my mind. To really value wisdom means to say I'm not looking for anything else but the idea. I'm looking for the truth, and that's enjoyable. That's how God created us, with a mind that we can perceive and uncover new ideas, and those ideas can be so enjoyable and true. God wants man to have the most enjoyable existence. And the most enjoyment is going to come from that part of his makeup which can be involved in the highest level of pleasure. Physical pleasures, there's a limit, number one, how much you can eat, how much sex you can have, how much energy you have, you're tired, there's only so much. Even after a certain amount of eating or intercourse, you'll be perceiving pain. So the physical is so limited, and all the factors that go into having a pleasant vacation are so numerous, the variables are just so innumerable that everything works out fine. There's no control. There's frustration met left and right, and there's just areas out of your control, weather, delays, so on and so forth. On the flip side, wisdom is something which you don't need anything physical to do. You can do it any moment. You can think into an area wherever you are, and you can pursue it, and there's no physical exertion, so you don't get tired. And the enjoyment that you get is something which that part of you, your soul, is where that's where it registers, on the soul. Not on your senses, not on your organs. The pleasure will register on a part of you which is more fulfilling and gratifying, because part of the gratification is a sense that this is really bigger than just me. This is really the whole world of wisdom. It's not a simple sensation that is short-lived for a few minutes or a few seconds. It's something which the part of the person that realizes the enormity of the whole world, how it works by wisdom, and this is something which is synonymous with God, the whole world of wisdom. So it impacts the person in such a way that it just overwhelms the person with enjoyment. The person is looking to feel physically good, and that's all he wants. He will not get the enjoyment from the wisdom. He can start applying himself and learning and studying, and he'll slowly start seeing that what he thought was pleasurable in the physical world is overshadowed 1,000 times by the pleasure he gets in the world of wisdom. Now, in order to have that enjoyment, in order to have that pleasure in wisdom, so a person can't have any ulterior motive. There can't be anything else which he's focusing in on. So the only way you can really have the ultimate enjoyment of knowledge is when you're just doing it for the knowledge itself. And you enjoy it, and you're not thinking in the back of your mind, what reward is God going to give me for this? Because then you're not pursuing it because you want to see the idea, then you're pursuing it because you think this big prize I'm getting in the next world. So in order to allow man the ability and the time and the immersion into the world of wisdom, where he enjoys the wisdom for the thing itself, which is the highest level. So therefore, he can't have a feeling that he's dying tomorrow, because that's going to keep his focus on, well, what's going to happen next. In order to have the focus on the here and now, there has to be a sense that I am here and now, and I'm not going anywhere, and I'm staying here. It's true, some point during the day later on, he might reflect, you know, I'm getting older, this and that, I know that, you know, everybody passes away at a certain point. But while he's involved in those hours of study, he has to have a feeling of permanence in order that he really isn't enjoying the wisdom for no other reason than just the wisdom itself. Okay?
I get it.
All right, Darryl, you got it?
Yes, sir, Rabbi.
Okay. So that's why King Solomon is saying that. But you see, why does he bring that up here? Because weren't we just talking before about security, how a person's looking, oh, let me do this. This is going to be security forever. No, King Solomon says, no, there's a time for this. Oh, let me go after that. No, King Solomon says again, there's a time for that. It's not always a good. Use your intelligence. So also a person looks for the ultimate security, the second level of security. That security, what's going to happen in the next world. You see? That's why this fits in over here. Because it's part of his discussion of where does man look for security. He looks for security here on earth in numerous different cases. King Solomon says, no. All these numerous cases, there's a time for this. There's a time for that. Where else does he look for security? Oh, what's going to ultimately happen to me? Don't look for the security over there. Because the real good, if you want the real good, you'll have to be focusing in on this life with a sense of immortality so you can really engage in wisdom for the sake of wisdom and not for the concerns. Right? That's why he says at the end of 12, we can answer the question now, that the only thing that's really good for man is that he should be happy and to do the good in his life. Now you see why he uses the word life. He's trying to tell you that you have to be focused here. Of course you can't do good in the next world. That's over. But his point over here is that the life has to be the focus. It has to be the here without looking. Because if you're looking for reward for doing the Torah, then you're not doing the Torah because it makes sense to you intelligently. You're doing it because you have an ulterior motive. You want some grand reward. You don't think that the Torah is the best thing itself, but if the Torah is the good itself, if living aligned with reason and seeing the ideas and seeing wisdom is the best thing, so you can't tell me, be involved in wisdom and I'll give you X. Then you're telling me that there's something better than wisdom. So you're telling a person, win the lottery and I'll give you $5. No, I don't need the incentive. The lottery itself is what I want. So to hear, if wisdom is really what the person wants, so then, and that is the most, that is the absolute good, so then the whole concept of reward doesn't apply. And that's exactly what the rabbis talked about. Because really, what happens, they said, in the next world? The righteous are sitting with the crowns on their head, enjoying the presence of God. What does it mean, they're sitting with crowns on their head? It means they are now reaping the benefits of their head, of the intelligence, of the life of wisdom. That's what I mean, crowns on the head. They now have honor given to them in the form of an eternal state where they can be involved in this pursuit for eternity without any type of, like Maimonides says, the next world is not physical. So there's no need for eating or sleeping or standing or reclining or relaxing, and there's no physical pain. It's the soul which is now enjoyed this life. If the soul enjoyed this life here and enjoyed wisdom, so then God gives it an enduring state where it sees even more. But that's only if we were able to involve ourselves here in study and appreciation of wisdom without any ulterior motive, and we actually viewed it as all we wanted, and we're not looking for anything additional. Because as long as a person says, I'll keep the Torah, as long as God gives me a reward afterwards, so then he doesn't really have the right appreciation. He doesn't understand. It's like a person says, I'll eat food and nourish my body in order that something else can happen. No. You nourish your body because that's a good thing in and of itself. If you don't nourish your body, you'll feel faint and you'll eventually die. You do it because, hey, I'm enjoying this steak because this steak really is good. There's no ulterior motive when the person eats a steak. Or a glass of wine. The enjoyment is of the thing itself. If we could use that as a metaphor for what we're discussing. Okay, so we see how those two verses are connected. All right, so let me stop here and let me just see if there are any questions or comments. We said a lot.
I think we're good here.
Okay. But it's just great now that you see how the verses tie into each other and how the theme is continued. And the questions that we have are answered. This is, I think, one of the most fundamental things we talked about in terms of what our attitude has to be towards wisdom and life. And it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, a few minutes a day or a few hours a day. If our real value in life is this the good that God has given us and that Torah and to see wisdom and to be morally correct with our peers and with our colleagues, with our family, and to be honest to ourselves. So this is really what our whole objective is. I mean, God knows exactly when we twist the truth and when we do things that are a little bit sly and crooked. He knows. We have to answer for it. So we shouldn't be doing that. Also, it trains us to stay away from real truth. And since we're trying to pursue truth in this life, so it's all the more important that we, any, you know, like, it's an open verse in the Torah that says, from a falsehood, you must distance yourself from a falsehood. So there was once a story Rabbi Chait talked about, and he said how there was this man. It was a funny story, and any time the man asked his wife for onion soup, so she gave him potato soup. Any time he asked for potato soup, so she gave him onion soup. He never got what he wanted. So one time he wanted onion soup. He told the son, "Go tell your mom to make some onion soup." So the son was smart, and he said to his mother, "You know, Dad wants potato soup." So sure enough, she made onion soup. The son got it, brought it to the father, and the father said, "How'd you do that?" So he said, "I know that you always get the opposite of what you ask for. So I told Mom that you wanted the other one." So he said, "I'm glad I got the onion soup, but don't do it again." Meaning, don't lie. He was trying to tell him, you should not become a friend to a lie, because that'll affect the person. And it'll be easier the next time. And you should really go after the truth. Of course, there are times when you're allowed to lie, and the Torah tells you, you go to a wedding, your friend asks you, "Hey, what do you think of my bride?" You say, no matter what she looks like, you say she's beautiful. Right? Or if you go to somebody's house for food, and you have a nice meal, so your friends ask you, "Hey, how does that guy's wife cook?" So you're allowed to say she's not a good cook, because if you say that she is good, then she's going to start getting people calling her up, and she's going to have to cook more and more, so you're allowed to lie in that situation too. Or you could lie about how much knowledge you have. So there's different areas there because there's a greater good involved. So, I mean, to say, you see again, like King Solomon says, the time for this is the time for that. Sometimes it's not the time to tell the truth. Because there's a greater good. The greater good is in terms of that there should be peace. The backdrop you need for in order to have the Torah operating is a peaceful society. So when you lie to your friend about his wife's appearance, it gives him a good feeling. You've created a peaceful, good, harmonious state for him, so that the rest of his life he can have a good feeling when he sees you. Or that the woman is not going to be inundated with too many guests, because that's going to ruin the peace of her household. Or that a person shouldn't be hoardy and arrogant about how much he learns. It's not about me. He should be, I don't know much. Be humble. Because in terms of the pursuit of truth, you need peace and you need humility. So you see that justifies those cases where you're allowed to lie. Everything has to be assessed intelligently. and of course by the Torah's guidelines. And you'll find that in all those cases, it will give you an appreciation. Okay. Okay, so maybe we'll hold up here. We'll pick up at verse 13. Actually, we won't be having class next week because we'll be all together in town. And so we'll pick up in 2 weeks. And like I said, if there's any questions or topics you want to take up next weekend, so let me know. I'd be more than happy to do it. And before we go, so is there any questions or comments on what we did today?
I think we're good. Thank you, Rabbi. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Sure. Naomi, you good? Rivka, Daryl, Josh?
Yeah, hey, thanks. Yeah, it was really good.
Okay, how about Laura Yoshiyahu, JHS online? I haven't seen any, I'm just looking to see if anybody typed any questions, but it's been pretty absent of any comments, so hopefully that means everything was clear. Sometimes when you have too many questions, that means you're not doing a good job presenting, but if there's no questions, sometimes it's a very good indication that you answer things, so hopefully that's the case here today. Okay, JSS, my pleasure, Laura. Yoshiyahu, you still with us? Any questions? There, it looks like we're okay. All right then, so we will resume in 2 weeks, but I'll see everybody, I guess, during this week.
That will be
sounds good, Rabbi. Thanks so much.
Okay, my pleasure. Looking forward to seeing you all.
Yep, us too. Be well.
Great.